couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, What's Love Got to Do with It, Star Wars Visions Season 2, Silo, and Citadel. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring the Ropers, pulling that out of the vault. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's quickly breeze through the box office, because there's a bigger news story going on, and it's just the point that Super Mario Brothers movie did very well. It did, like, over $40 million, almost $41 million last weekend, which is fantastic. It reached $1 billion worldwide. It is a massive hit. Evil Dead Rise only dropped about 50%, which is a big drop, but not for a horror film. Horror films tend to drop pretty heavily in their second weekend. 50% hold isn't bad for a horror film. I mean, it's something like, I think Smile eased a lot, and that's why Smile last year had such a great run. But Evil Dead Rise also did well, and it looks like it's going to be another good year for horror films. Now, the big one that came out last week was Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Came in third with only $6.7 million, which is lower than studio expectations. People were predicting maybe up to $10 million, but even then they were thinking at least 7 to 9. Now, there's some reasons why it didn't click, and I saw people going, well, you know, adaptations of young adult books like The Hunger Games do well, and I'm like, there is a chasm of difference between Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, and Hunger Games. I mean, Hunger Games has more connective tissue with the Transformer movies than it does with Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I think the biggest reason why this underperformed is that maybe just the book's kind of old. The book is not something that 11 and 12-year-old girls are reading now. It was a thing that the tweens were reading in the 70s and the 80s, and I still think it's a great movie and it's worth seeing, but I think the mothers were more interested in the movie. Look, performance does not necessarily mean that it's not a good film. It's a great movie, but also it really had a limited potential. You know, I mean, you're pretty much talking about tween girls and their mothers who might have interest in this movie. But the big surprise, which was a great way to kick off Star Wars week, because of course you had Star Wars Day on Thursday, May the 4th be with you, Star Wars Episode 6, Return of the Jedi, came in fourth place with $5.1 million. It was a 40th anniversary re-release in the theaters, whereas other movies, like even the big George Foreman movie, came in like 11th place. It was outside of the top 10. But let's wrap up the box office and talk about the big news this week. The WGA has decided to go on strike. And it's been, about 16 years since we had a writer's strike? We had one in, I think, 2007. And first of all, I just want to go out there on the record and say I completely support the writers on this one. Look, I know there's people who have different ideas about unions or whatever, but I know writers in the industry. I'm not a television or film writer, in particular television writers. They're the ones that are going after the residuals. It's always about residuals. It's never about upfront payments, even though that's involved. It's about residuals, because when streaming started, people forget that, you know, 15 years ago, streaming started as, you know, you missed Grey's Anatomy, you can go on abc.com and watch it. And that was streaming. And those were very small numbers, and it had very little revenue. That was long before streaming became a huge thing. And streaming has overtaken cable. But the money that the people are paid for residuals are not being reflected in the streaming products. I mean, it used to be if you worked on a sitcom and you hit 100 episodes, you could go into syndications and writers and actors and producers and directors got paid, I mean, not loads of cash, but they got paid a good amount of money for their work that keeps earning money for the studio. And it just was never negotiated that way for streaming. And now streaming is arguably bigger than reruns, for sure. So they need to be fairly compensated. Where you can really see the chasm is somebody posted what the writers have requested and what their demands are. And the response from the studios, half of their demands were they didn't even get a response. They didn't even get a counteroffer. And what that says to me is this thing's going to last for a long time. The last writer's strike was like 100 days, which is a long time. Now, you may not feel the pinch immediately unless you're a fan of like late night programming like The Tonight Show or Saturday Night Live. That stuff's going to feel the immediate pinch because that is being produced on a day-to-day basis. But you're not going to start seeing a real slowdown in content right away because the writing is an early process and they've got some stuff already in development. But here's the thing. You can't shut down part of your development chain and then have things run smoothly. It's like your digestive system. If your stomach is working too fast or too slow for the rest of your system, it'll cause problems. Same thing if your colon's working too fast or too slow. It doesn't matter if the other things are working fine. You have to have everything moving smoothly through. The bottom line is there's solidarity there. They voted for the authority to strike with something like a 90-some percent vote. And there's a lot of other guilds that are glomming onto this because streaming is a new technology. Anytime you had new technology, when you had VHS, there was a fight over the rights to that and the money that would come to them. Same thing as when you had DVD coming up and now you have streaming. And when you had television changing and you had cable showing up, you have these writer strikes all the time. The bottom line is don't listen to the pundits who don't know anything about the writing. Listen to the writers. Like if there's a teacher strike, my wife's a teacher. When there's a teacher strike, you don't go talk to somebody who hasn't stepped foot in a real classroom for decades and that the last time they went into a grade school classroom was when they were in grade school. You go ask the teachers. You find out what the real problems that they're facing before you start tearing them down and saying, oh, you're already making too much money or something like that. Because the reality is most writers are living hand to mouth. Yeah, you can find the writers that make a ton of money, but this is not the majority of them. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to talk about has hit this week, and that is Dune Part 2, which comes to theaters on November 3rd.
In the shadows of Arrakis lie many secrets. But the darkest of them all may remain. The end of House Atreides.
My father didn't believe in revenge.
What if Paul Atreides were still alive?
Have you ever had a dream about your first ride?
Look, I respect Denis Villeneuve and his directing techniques. But every time I see a frame of any of this Dune stuff, all I want to do is go back and watch the David Lynch version. That thing was crazy and amazing at the same time. And yeah, it was divisive. But that was a real masterpiece, and I will die on that hill loving David Lynch's version of Dune. And Dune Part 2, it looks like more sand. I don't think it looks epic. It looks monochromatic, and that was my problem with the first film. The next one I want to talk about is The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. I didn't even know this was a thing, but it's coming to theaters on November 17th.
I have summoned you all here for the 10th Annual Reaping Ceremony, in which we choose two children from each district to fight to the death in the Hunger Games. As a mentor, Mr. Snow, your role is to turn these children into spectacles, not survivors.
Enjoy the show.
What happens in there? See how quickly we become predator? See how quickly civilization disappears?
It looks like they already filmed the negotiations for the WGA strike. Did we need more Hunger Game movies? I don't think we did. Apparently, there's this book was written, and it was a bestseller, but there are some great actors in here. You got Viola Davis, you got Peter Dinklage, but I don't even know what the story's about, and it doesn't feel very compelling to begin with. So here's two big blockbuster films for the holidays that are leaving me kind of cold. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about What's Love Got to Do with It, and Silo.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me no more.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about What's Love Got to Do with It. No, not that one. Not the Tina Turner biopic from like 30 years ago. I'm talking about a new one, which stars Lily James. And the story is about a documentary filmmaker who examines her friend's journey with an arranged marriage.
I'm getting married.
You are?
Who's the lucky lady?
Don't know yet.
What do you mean?
I'm getting an arranged marriage. Well, assisted marriage. That's what we're calling it these days.
Dare I ask, what about love?
You grow to love the person you're with.
What, like Stockholm Syndrome?
So, your ideas for your next film?
I could follow my childhood friend to marry a stranger chosen by his parents.
My big fat arranged wedding.
Me the parents first.
Love contractually.
Huh. As I said before, this movie stars Lily James, and it also stars Shahzad Latif. If you don't know who he is, he's shown up in a bunch of stuff. I most recognize him from playing a character on Star Trek Discovery. He was a Klingon that was surgically made to look human. That's how I'll always, I'm like, hey, look, it's that Klingon. That's how I will always remember him. But he plays a British-born Pakistani citizen. He's been friends with Lily James's character ever since they were kids. And he decides to engage in a, no pun intended, an arranged marriage or a assisted marriage. As you hear in the trailer, that's what they're called now. And that's still common practice in both India and Pakistan. There's a lot of people who have Indian and Pakistani heritage in Britain, mainly because of the colonization that went on there in the 20th century. But this is the story of him, a very traditional, conservative Pakistani family that wants to arrange his marriage, and it's him going through with it, and him openly going through it, that he's not being pressured. And Lily James, it's clear her character, they're supposed to be in love and they've been in love ever since they were kids, but they've never mentioned it. But of course, she's not Muslim and she's not Pakistani. So it was never an option for them. And this is meant to show the evolution of very, very traditional marriage from those countries. And we've seen movies and television shows address the arranged marriage thing. Now, to most people in the United States, that just seems kind of jarring. We're not used to it. But that is, like I said, that's very common practice. I have a friend who's in an arranged marriage. He's very happy. And he's like, oh yeah, he met his wife on his wedding day, which to me is madness. But he's talked about it. They've grown to love each other. They've got kids and they're very happy together. But I've seen Hollywood struggle with this because, of course, everything from the early Disney films are you marry who you love and you don't do what your family tells you. And now we have two very strong cultures, India and Pakistan, who do engage in this. And this is sort of the way things are. And so, I mean, it does do a really good job of trying to open that up and make it look the way it is in a modern situation, because it's a jarring thought for a lot of, you know, us, you know, white people in the world who are looking, or just anybody who doesn't have that background to it. It's predictable at times. You know where it's going. The part of the thing is I'm not a huge Lily James fan. Yeah, she's pretty and all. I just don't, I've never seen anything she's been in that I found her remotely compelling. I've always found her to be boring. So her as the lead to this kind of makes me want to snooze. And it's part of the thing is the movie, it tries to do these two things, and they're kind of at odds with each other at times, because on one hand, it's trying to give a culturally sensitive look at arranged marriage and to show the structure of a Pakistani family, which is very similar to, you know, an Indian family, but you still see that same marital structure. And we've seen, you know, got a glimpse at sort of that Pakistani lifestyle with Ms. Marvel. And there's been a lot of stuff, a lot of Indian characters have shown up. And I think New Girl had this storyline with an arranged marriage at one point. But then it has this whole thing where Lily James is this woman in her 30s and she's in London and she's trying to have a life and go through the dating thing and all the problems that she's facing. And it's supposed to show the two extremes, you know, the swipe right culture and the very conservative arranged marriage culture. And I get what they're trying to do, but they really are at odds. And the characters are so different that I don't buy them together. And Sharad Latif's character is so, everything else about him is very modern and very, homogeneous to British culture, except for when he goes home to his folks. And so, I don't know, it packs too much in the story, but at least it attempts to give a balanced look at diverse wedding traditions. So, I mean, it's a realistic movie, although it stumbles a bit on its own ideas. But still, I mean, kind of for what it is, and if you like the romance type thing, I mean, that's who it's made for. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Silo. This is on Apple TV Plus. It's a science fiction series. 140 years after a serious event, the last people on Earth survive in an underground environment, but some question their past.
Don't you ever think about the world beyond the silo?
What if what we see is not what's out there?
Data Mechanical. There's always someone who has a theory about the silo. I need to find out the truth.
I found something that might hold the answers to a lot of questions.
You have to stay quiet. And keep your head down.
Apple TV Plus, they don't do gee whiz sci-fi. They try to do heady, at times experimental, but also very intellectual sci-fi. They did Foundation, and they had what, Invasion, I think, is another one that they did. There's a bunch of them that they have, and I would like to see something a little more fun come out of Apple TV in terms of a science fiction thing. Part of the thing is they're trapped in the silo, and nobody can go outside because it's supposed to be poisonous outside. But the people who say they want to go outside, then they're kicked outside, and they have to clean like this camera lens. I don't understand. Buy a windshield wiper. But they clean this camera lens, and then they end up dying out there, and it's a sacrifice. It has a great cast. Let me just say that. I mean, like, there's a lot of good people in this movie. David Oyelowo plays one of the characters, and he's really good. And Rashida Jones has a smaller part, and she's good. And you've got Rebecca Ferguson is kind of the anchor for it, even though it takes her a couple episodes to get in there. She's really good. Tim Robbins plays one of the mucky mucks up there in the society. So it has some great actors in it. It actually has some pretty decent writing. It's just my biggest problem is I've seen all this before. I mean, this is, we talked about the Hunger Games earlier. It's all this dystopian stuff. I mean, this is like Snowpiercer, where you have instead of they're being trapped on a train, they're trapped in this underground silo that has something like 100 floors to it. And they don't know who built it, but they're there and they have to believe that they're trapped there. But then there are people who want to go out and, you know, they can't look into their past. I mean, it hits all those notes, and I've just seen it all. The only difference is that it doesn't have some bland teenage girl who everyone falls in love with, which is, I guess, that fell away with Twilight. But I don't know. It's just, I mean, it's derivative of various dystopian science fiction series, but it is held together by a great cast and some better than average writing. I haven't seen the whole thing, so I don't know how much of a payoff it's going to have. I'm going to be nice, and I'll say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 and Star Wars Visions Season 2. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. When Rocket is critically injured, the Guardians must confront the dark forces in his past to try to save him.
Met a girl, fell in love. That girl died, but then she came back a total dick.
Oh, please. He left out some important information, but that is the gist of it.
My sacred mission is to create the perfect society.
He didn't want to make things perfect. He just hated things the way they are.
This is the third, obviously, Guardians of the Galaxy movie, but of course they've shown up in a bunch of other things. You know, they showed up in the Infinity War and Endgame. And one of the challenges with a movie about a group of characters is spreading it around. The first two movies were very much about Star-Lord, Chris Pratt's character, Peter Quill. And even the Avengers Endgame and Infinity War movies had that big focus on him, you know, being upset that Gamora got killed. And of course, the new version of Gamora is back, but it's an alternate version, so she hasn't had the experience with them. And so then she's got stuff to work through, and Peter Quill's got stuff to work through, but it's not their movie. They get a little bit of lip service, but it's not their movie. It's Rocket's movie. It delves a lot into Rocket's past. And that's good, because we really haven't gotten a look at Rocket. I mean, we got more development with Mantis and Drax in the holiday special than we got with Rocket. And he's the one that's been left unexplored, and so they're exploring his character. And they do a really good job, and it's very sweet. They look into where he came from and why he is the way he is and what he is. And it also plays around with that. There's a darkness underlying these Marvel movies where you got people that create worlds and destroy them on a whim. I mean, Endgame and Infinity War were about a genocidal madman. I mean, who's doing it on a galactic scale. Genocide is not a fun topic, but they managed to make it something you could work with. And Star Wars does similar things. I mean, they got people blowing planets up and stuff like that. And so the new bad guy in this is the Evolutionary, and he's basically this godlike character that keeps trying to manipulate the genome of a main species of a planet that he can make it, you know, docile and control and everything. And he has a background with Rocket. And the fact that Rocket is given a chance to show his emotion, show his background. And Bradley Cooper is playing Rocket. I mean, he does the voice. I don't know if he does mocap for him, but he does the voice. And he really brings a certain level of humanity. I mean, it's bizarre to think that it takes this genetically engineered raccoon to really delve into the humanity of the Guardians of the Galaxy. It's very different from the other two movies, but also very similar because it has the humor. It has the completely bizarre alien environments. It has the cosmic craziness that goes on, but it's also very grounded because ultimately it's a bunch of folks hanging around together and dealing with a bunch of jerks along the way. But it's very fun. And, you know, James Gunn, you know, he got through a political thing. He got kicked off of the third Guardians of the Galaxy movie, ended up making the Suicide Squad and Peacemaker, and then came back to do Guardians of the Galaxy, and now he's in charge of DC stuff. So he has to kind of say sayonara to Marvel. It makes sense because he's in charge of DC. He can't be making Marvel movies while he's in charge of DC. But I know I got to give him credit. This guy, he started off making trauma movies. I mean, he started off making, like, what, Romeo and Juliet or something like that? He made real schlock. And he's become one of the biggest directors on the planet. And I've got to say, there's not been a James Gunn movie I've not liked. I've enjoyed all of them I've seen. I don't think I've seen everything he's done. But this one, what I appreciate about this is two things. First of all, they managed to tell a different story than the last two movies and to take it out of Peter Quill's hands. Because you don't want it to be Peter Quill and the gang. It's the Guardians of the Galaxy. And being able to give the spotlight to another character is great. And of course, he uses all the comedic elements, especially Drax and Mantis. I could watch a whole series of them. I think they're fantastic. One of the villains that shows up, who's played by Will Powder, he's okay. They're not very well developed there. But still, I mean, it tells a different story. It's not just Star-Lord whinging about his mom. But it gives Peter Quill some story, too. It doesn't just snatch it away from everybody. But it also gives them a chance to all work together again. That was one of the things they do in the sequel, usually. That first one, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, they had to split everybody up. And this one, everyone's kind of split up, but they're all together. But you get the crazy characters and everything. It is rare for you to get three movies from the same characters, from the same directors, that are bangers, all three right in a row. And I think you do with this one. It's less about Star-Lord's hang-ups and more of a character study of Rocket, but this offers an intriguing diversion from the previous films. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Star Wars Visions Season 2. This dropped on May the 4th, Star Wars Day, this week. 9 more animated takes on the Star Wars universe.
Everyone has an inner light.
Follow the light.
I always knew you were meant for bigger things.
What if you just keep going?
No need to fear. There are others like you here.
I saw it myself. She has special powers.
Can you get your porta potty off the starting line?
She's a total... Exactly.
Don't be afraid.
May the Force be with you.
Now, here's the thing. They started Star Wars Visions a couple years ago. And the idea was they took, I think it was like 9 animations, anime studios, actually. It wasn't just animation. It was actually anime, which is usually Japanese, and there's Korean anime. But there's a real certain style and timber and delivery of anime. Even though anime can be diverse within itself, it is a subsect of animation. And I can appreciate anime. I'm not a huge fan. Like, my kids are big fans of anime. I mean, I've seen some anime and I like it, but there are certain tropes that show up in anime that annoy me. And they showed up in that first season of Star Wars Visions. This one, they've said, okay, we're not just doing anime. There is one anime studio that works on it. It's a Korean anime studio. And they do one of the episodes. But there's 9 episodes. And they're just done by animation. And you get different styles. You get CGI, you get stop motion, you get cell animation, you get computer assisted 2D animation. There's a whole range of styles here and a range of countries and backgrounds. There's one that's from India. There's one done by Aardman, which is British, and they're kind of goofy. They're the ones who do Shaun the Sheep and Wallace and Gromit. And there's one done by Cartoon Saloon. I love Cartoon Saloon. They did Wolfwalkers most recently, but they did stuff like The Secret of the Kells and The Song of the Sea. They're Irish, and they have a very distinct style. What's so brilliant about this is all 9 episodes are vastly different. Now, they're all Star Wars, and they all fit in the Star Wars universe, but they're very different styles and very different approaches. And the animation is beautiful. Whereas, like, the first season was several different styles within that anime mindset. These are several different styles wherever the wind takes them. And there's some in there that are very serious and very adult and very dark. And there are some that are kind of whimsical and fun. The Aardman one's a hoot. I mean, it's very accessible. So I love this. I think it really opens up the Star Wars universe, because not only is it different styles, they're basically said, tell whatever story you want to, just make sure it takes place somewhere in Star Wars. And so it's not all about Luke Skywalker or people we know or Darth Vader or anything like that. A lot of this is, you know, some of it takes place at different eras. I mean, it's a beautifully done series. If you didn't like season 1 of Star Wars Vision, I suggest checking out season 2, because it really blew me away. Stretching beyond the bounds of anime, these innovative Star Wars stories open up the galaxy's narrative potential. It's fantastic. Star Wars Visions Season 2 totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent. Next up on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Citadel and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring the Ropers. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on and finish up the reviews. Let's talk about Citadel. Now, this has been out for a week. It's on Amazon Prime or Prime Video. And it's actually made a bit of news recently, mainly because it's one of the most expensive TV shows ever made. It's got the Russo brothers behind it, the guys who did Avengers Endgame and Infinity War. And if they aren't working on an Avengers project, it's kind of iffy. I know they did The Gray Man for Netflix, and that was a big hit for them. But they did stuff like 21 Bridges, which is one of Chadwick Boseman's final films. But they did that. That one was very good. The Russo brothers, just because they're involved, does not mean it's going to be a great property. So it's interesting because they have access to a lot of things. but I think they still have to prove themselves outside of the Avengers. And I mean, they just basically produce this. They're not the showrunners. But it became very expensive. It's something like $30 million an episode or $50 million, whatever it is. It turns out to be $200 to $300 million for this series, which is basically vying, depending on how you cut the numbers, it's vying with Rings of Power, which is also a Prime Video series, as the most expensive TV series ever made. Let's just talk about why I think Amazon did this, why they were okay spending the money. But let's talk about the show itself. After an international spy ring is destroyed, two agents with amnesia team up to take down those who pulled the trigger. Sweet dreams
are made of the... Who you were was a myth. Who you were was Citadel. A spy agency loyal to no nation. 8 years ago, we were double-crossed by one of our own.
We've created a new order. It's only a matter of time.
Understood.
And now, I need your help.
What's going on here?
It's the only way.
You can never find out.
Just as a spy series, it's fine. It feels like, you know, something like, do you remember Human Target? It was a series, I think they had about two seasons back, maybe 15 years ago, or something like 24. These kind of spy series, only it's much higher production value, obviously. If you're going to spend $30 million an episode, it better look really good. But yeah, they got international locations, and they got explosions. They have a train derailment in the first episode. I mean, it's all CGI, but I mean, they spend some money on this. It's well done. I mean, it works. As just a rote spy series, it's fine. You got the two characters. Richard Madden plays the one male spy. And Priyanka Chopra Jonas plays the female spy. So they have that sort of sexual chemistry, that on again, off again. You know, they're both attractive people. And they do play it up. So it does get a little bit, you know, at times overly slick and, you know, unrealistic. I mean, it's not, it is that Hollywood spy show. But it doesn't overdo it too much. Sometimes these shows get just so dripping with machismo. And this one doesn't. I mean, actually, Richard Madden's is kind of very accessible in this. Chopper's okay. I mean, she doesn't quite nail the acting. She was a big star in India, but now she's really trying to break into, the English language market. And I mean, she has to a certain degree. I mean, this show's certainly, I mean, whether you want it to be or not, it's going to be a hit. And here's why. And I'll talk about this, why I think it's, they're spending that much money. This is not made just for an American audience. I mean, you don't put Priyanka Chopra in your show and expect it to just only play well in the States. This is for an international audience. I mean, Chopra is obviously Indian, so she's looks international. Richard Madden is kind of, he could pass for almost anything. You could believe he's Persian. You could believe he's Italian. He's kind of got that dark look to him. So it should play well in other countries, particularly India, Pakistan, in some of the Asian countries, especially Southern Asian countries. That's why they're spending that much money. That's my theory. They're like, they don't mind doing this. This is sort of like the Fast and Furious movies. The reason those movies are so popular, it's not just because of the United States box office, it's the international box office. And it's because it's a multicultural cast. The people who are seeing the movies get to see themselves in the films. And that's why those movies do well, and that's why this series, I think, is probably a good investment for Amazon. So no matter what the American numbers are, let's look at the numbers overseas, how much money they can make there. But I mean, overall, it's fine. I mean, I don't think it's worth the money they're spending. There's a time where you're like, well, I aside from having somebody walk in there and drop $20 million on the floor and set it on fire, I don't see it on the screen, but I also don't do budgeting for TV series. So I don't know what caused their budget to skyrocket, but I mean, it's a perfectly passable action series. It's slick. Not too loaded with machismo, but this is a fun, if not routine, spy series. I enjoy it. It's certainly one you can kind of turn your brain off and watch on a Friday evening. So I'll say Citadel kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I'm going way into the vault for this one, and I found this on Tubi TV. I'm a big fan of Tubi. Tubi, the one of the things I love about Tubi, and you'll see this with what I'm going to be talking about here, is Tubi gives you options for older programming. You know, you can get older programming, a lot of stuff, but like if you go to Netflix, there's not a whole lot of stuff on Netflix that was made outside of the 21st century. But Tubi has loads of nostalgic television. Amazon Prime and Freevee have a bunch too. But Tubi has a bunch of cool stuff on there. And I swerved into The Ropers. If you don't know the history, Three's Company was a series. Obviously, a lot of people know about that one. Jack Tripper, played by John Ritter. It was based on a British series called Man About the House. And when that was a success in the UK, they spun it off to The Ropers, which were George and Mildred, their landlords in the original British show. And they had their own series that went on for a couple of years. Well, after Three's Company did well, they spun off The Ropers. And they said, let's do a spinoff. And they brought Stanley and Helen, and that allowed them to spin that off. And then, of course, we got Ralph Furley, played by Don Knotts, to be the new landlord. But in The Ropers, this spinoff from Three's Company sees Stanley and Helen Roper retiring to a townhouse only to annoy their new neighbors.
Tomorrow at 7:30 on The Ropers, Stanley and Helen move into their new townhouse.
Look at this. We've had this for 20 years.
It's a long time to keep a broken vase.
So why didn't you empty the teapot before you packed it?
It is empty.
Now it's empty. My brassiere is full of tea leaves. Look at that.
Join the Ropers tomorrow at 7:30 on TV 29.
That was a promo from an old TV network. I found it on YouTube. They didn't make trailers for the Ropers back then, but it gives you an idea of kind of the banter they have. The thing is, when I remember watching this occasionally, I caught it on like weird reruns and stuff back when I was a kid, and I was a big fan of Three's Company growing up, but I didn't like the Ropers. I was not a fan of the Ropers characters on the show. I was more a fan of Ralph Furley. But you know what's funny is as I started, I just on a whim, I said, well, let me see how terrible this is. Because I remember it as being terrible. And I started watching it and I'm like, this is actually kind of a funny show. Audra Lindley, she gets a little annoying at times. And they do some cast changes in the second season. They bring in this vagrant who looks like a reject from a Godspell audition. But it's this girl who starts living with him. I think they wanted to get a younger character on the show. But like the people next door, They're played by Jeffrey Tambor. He's very funny in this, and it's kind of in his heyday of physical comedy. And Patricia McCormick, who played the bad seed in the movie The Bad Seed, she played the little blonde girl in that. She plays the mom. And they have real good chemistry together. The reason this, I think, works for especially Norman Fell, I think it really gives him a chance to shine because it allowed him to no longer just be the grumpy guy. He was no longer the passive antagonist. He was the main character and he was the one causing the problems for somebody else. And it gave him a chance to be kind of goofy and silly. It really gave him more opportunities to have some fun than you ever got in the Three's Company series. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed this. It ran for a season and a half. I mean, it's technically two seasons. I think the first season was like 6 episodes. The second season's like 20. But it's a good show. I really enjoyed it. I found it very breezy, easy to watch. Yeah, it's stupid. It's very steeped in the 70s, 80s, because it started in 1979 and went to 1980. I mean, it's dumb. But it's right on line for these movies. It should have gotten renewed for another season. They were supposed to, but then they just didn't. And I think Norman Fell was PO'd about that for the rest of his life. So it's an at-home 1970 sitcom that is much funnier than I originally remember. And it gives Norman Fell a real chance to highlight his comedic talent. I'm going to have to say The Ropers, surprisingly. I never thought I'd say this, but The Ropers totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Book Club, the next chapter, and Blackberry. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.